This is a London Undone podcast. My name is Catherine Cartwright. These podcasts give you an audible insight into some curious places around London. This series focuses on the historic and at times peculiar City of London churches, their histories, features, associations, and their spiritual lives.
I'm Signe Hoffus. I'm a trustee of the Friends of the City Churches, and we're sitting in one of the benches toward the back of St. Mary Abchurch.
St. Mary Abchurch is an unusual name. Do you know why it's called, well, not the St. Mary bit, but why Abchurch?
Well, the general speculation is either it means something like up church, because we're on the declivity leading down to the Thames, or it's up of some other church named St. Mary, of which there were many in the medieval city. Or it has a founder or an early priest who had a name something like Abba. And this is an explanation you'll find attached to a lot of churches with odd and inexplicable names.
Okay, thank you. And in terms of where we are in the city, you said we're up from the river. Where otherwise geographically are we at the moment?
We're just off Cannon Street, which has been a major east-west route for quite some time, although not quite as large and major as it is nowadays. Mm-hmm. And that is leading toward the banks of the Thames, which were a little bit closer in the Middle Ages than they have been since embankment. And we're toward the east side of the city, so we're very near Gracechurch Street, which is, of course, the heart of even the Roman city, reading north and south. So we're pretty central even from Roman times here.
Yeah, we are. In terms of the building we're in, let's talk about the outside first.
Well, like many of the city churches, it's deceptively simple outside because, of course, public money paid for the exteriors, the coal tax after the Great Fire of London, and there really wasn't a lot of money to spare, nor were there much by way of building materials, because everybody is rebuilding everything at the same time, houses and businesses, and the royal family and other grand institutions are also building largely around the suburbs of London. This is partly why Wren encouraged the royal family to build Kensington Palace in brick, because there just isn't enough stone. So it has a very plain, austere exterior. You can just see some windows and a nice little roof and a bit of a tower, nothing really fancy, like so many other Wren churches.
Yeah.
And then you step inside and the contrast is stunning. Yeah. It's just so full of rich and wonderful things and detail and unique features like the painted dome, which is the thing that probably strikes your eye first as you walk in. But then as you look around, you see it's also lined with beautiful monuments because it's never really had the kind of intervention that destroys monuments. And it also has box pews around the edges and the cut-down Victorian benches in the center. It is little decorative touches all over the place, and it has an absolutely crowning glory of a reredos, which does include genuine carving by Grinling Gibbons, as well as much fine carving by many other city carvers on Wren's larger team.
I've just done a podcast about St. Stephen Walbrook, and that has a dome. How does this fit into, and there's some Paul's, obviously, how does this dome fit into Christopher Wren's dome history?
Well, every church that has a dome, and there were more before the Luftwaffe intervention of the 1940s than there are now, is an experiment on the great geometric problem of how do you get something round and arced like a dome onto something fundamentally square or rectangular like a church. Mm. And this one, the church, it looks square at first, and then you realize that the gallery and the tower and so forth make it just rectangular. But here the dome is sitting straight on the walls with just little curved pendentives around the edges to draw your eye up. It's nothing so complicated as the arrangement at St. Stephen Walbrook, for example. And then even between this one and St. Stephen Walbrook was St. Swithin, and it had a dome like a little pepper pot. Unfortunately, there's nothing left of that now but a garden. And there was another dome at, it is one at St. Marriott Hill, which is actually so shallow people tend not to notice it at first. Mm-hmm. And there was one at St. George in the East, which is now, of course, a memorial park. So he's trying all these different configurations on different churches, working out the geometry and the visual aesthetic of it. He finds different ways of doing it in each church, and they all work.
And this one is painted. Would it have been painted in Christopher Wren's time?
He would have lived to have seen this. But basically, we think the painting went in about 1708. So this is basically a generation after the church was completed in the 1670s, 80s, when most of the churches were being completed. And if you look at an older guidebook, it will say Thornhill, because Thornhill was Wren's go-to top class painter. He's the, you know, St. Paul's Cathedral and the Painted Hall at Greenwich, but not everybody could afford him, and he couldn't do everything. And in fact, there were a lot of people painting in those days, because this is just before the great age of wallpaper, so decorated houses often had painted walls. And in fact, this is done by a man named William Snow, who lived across the street, I mean literally across the street, and he had many of his BMDs here. The children were baptized, he was married, some died and were buried here, and he probably decorated quite a few of the local houses as well. He did it, we think, about 1708, but we also know from going to the parish chest that the present iteration is the fourth conservation since 1708, because by 1900, with the coal smoke and the wood smoke and so forth, it was so dirty you couldn't see a thing. And then with the six rounds of collateral damage during the Blitz, no direct hit, but six rounds of other buildings being blown up very nearby, great hunks of it had fallen off and onto the floor, so it had to be restored again.
So it's a plaster ceiling.
Yes, and there's a lovely little picture at the back of the church showing you the war damage, and it's just wattle and daub, which will be familiar to many London homeowners. That's the way Victorian houses are made, with plaster walls, just woven little sticks in and out of uprights and then covered in plaster. So hats off to Duguid and Grove also, who are Wren's go-to plasterers, who did such a good job on the plaster that Mr. Snow could come along and paint afterward. They never get the credit, the plasterers.
No.
And honestly, their job is as time-consuming and as demanding as the painters.
Absolutely. What does it show? What does the painting show?
Well, you can just about see on a dull day, and you can see beautifully on a day with a bit of suffused light, that we have the virtues and we have angels in glory, and at the very center we have the rather arresting image of a tetragrammaton, which is the name of the Lord in Hebrew, the consonants only, of course, four characters, tetragrammaton. And this is a real millennial thing, which you'll find in a lot of Wren period churches and Hawksmoor. It just became something they wanted, and possibly having to do with kind of a complicated idea at the time involving tying the Old and the New Testaments together, and also welcoming the Jewish community back into London, because many people did believe you were coming to the end of days. And frankly, if you'd been born about 1620 and you'd lived through the run-up to the Civil War and all that dissension, and then two civil wars, and then the Commonwealth and the army occupation, and then the Restoration, and then the plague, and then the fire, yeah, you could honestly believe what's next. It's got to be Armageddon. So they're kind of getting this idea of fulfilling biblical prophecy by having the Old and New Testaments more closely united, which is also a bit of a message in the brand new Book of Common Prayer of 1662, and also having the Jewish community back integrated into the Christian community. They're kind of working toward some kind of millennial vision. Some people obviously more than others, but it all neatly ties in. And several of the churches have these things, and some of them in such odd ways. You think that once the church wardens at, say, St. Bennet's saw that everybody else was getting one, they wanted one, and they kind of tacked theirs on in a very awkward way. Here, as at, for example, Mary Woolnoth, it's beautifully integrated into the fabric of the church. And here it's absolutely the crowning glory of the dome, because it's smack dab in the center of the glory.
It's very striking.
Yes.
Sort of the thing that grabs you first, and there's nothing really around it apart from clouds. And,
yes.
And in terms of you referenced earlier the Reredos, the Grinling Gibbons carving. How do we know it's Grinling Gibbons?
Well, fortunately, this is a very late development, because people just used to write what the last guy wrote for years. The idea of primary sources in history is very modern. So in the 1950s, someone actually looked in the parish chest, and here are some papers from Grinling Gibbons asking if he's done enough work and will they pay him now. And we kind of have the fire to thank for this in an oblique way, because this parish was united with St. Lawrence Pulteney, or Pountney, which was not rebuilt. And in some cases, two churches united got on like a house, I hate to say house on fire in this context, but that was how it went. But some of them didn't get on at all, and they were constantly niggling, and this was a niggling one. So Lawrence Pulteney, there's two versions, wardens were always checking the expenses and complaining and making sure that every last penny was properly ascribed. And thanks to them, we've got these letters from Grinling Gibbons saying, yeah, it's my work, and please will you give me the £30 now?
And was it £30?
That's one of the figures mentioned, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Interesting. And it shows fruit and flowers.
The usual Grinling array, yeah. Yes. Beautiful things. I mean, there's much, much very fine carving in this church.
Would it have been that way in Christopher Wren's time?
Much of the wood would have been lighter. Certainly the carving would have been lighter.
Sure.
And but the thing is about lime wood, even if you see modern lime wood carvings, they do start to darken quite quickly.
Okay.
And if you added the wood smoke and the coal smoke and so forth, you can see why the Victorians just had to throw in the towel and stain things.
Yeah.
There's an urban legend that the reredos here was blasted into 2,000 pieces during the Blitz and so miraculously reconstructed that you can't see a single seam now. And now we've got tons of evidence from contemporary documents in the London Metropolitan Archive and in the church's own files here. And we think what actually happened was that it's beautifully, intricately carved in lots of little tiny pieces like a big 3D jigsaw, which is how Grinling Gibbons worked. And he had a fabulous 3D imagination. And this is kept together by glue and pins. And after so many centuries, when the blast field came from the poor old White Hart Hotel on the corner, bits started to pop off. And there is a touching description of the 70-odd-year-old Sexton S., as she was called, who took care of the church, crawling around in the rubble, picking up the Wren period woodwork before they swept up, lest it should be lost. It was a joiner named Miss Edward White who opened the box, presumably, the first time. And what would a contractor say when presented with a job that's way bigger than they were led to believe, but it's in 2,000 pieces.
Yes.
And then the rector quotes this, and then the Daily Telegraph quotes this, and it goes into urban. This vision only starts in the 1950s during conservation.
On the east side of the church is
Bank Station, yes.
Can you tell me a bit about what's happened as a result of the building work going on there?
Well, this is something that happens to a lot of city churches because they've, of course, been standing here for centuries. Their foundations are often medieval, which are not to modern standard. And many of them, they're all on London clay, and many of them, like this one, are on declivities heading toward the water. So it's not the most stable ground. And modern building practice doesn't help at all because, you know, the Victorians would sink a basement, maybe,
yeah,
a cellar.
Yeah.
Nowadays, they go right down to what you call in archaeology natural, as far as you can go.
Yeah.
And this creates a honking great hole, and the natural tendency of earth all around it is to go fill that hole.
Mm.
So there has been a fair amount of movement. But here we're part of an experimental project coming from Cambridge University, which is looking at ways of predicting movement. So we have monitors all over the church, which have been here for years, and they're just gently, gently monitoring the slightest movement in the hope that in future projects like this, you may be able to anticipate movement before anything happens,
yeah,
so that we hope to do better in future when it comes to trying to build new, large, tall buildings with deep basements next to old ones.
Yes, yes. And that makes me think, you were saying it has medieval foundations. The first time a church was built here, do we know the date of that?
This is problematic in almost every church, and you'll see some extraordinary claims from some which cannot substantiate them. But we think around the 12th century, so the 1100s. The first incumbent was called Roger the Surveyor. So that's all we have for names. But we've got a pretty good list of people who have rectors here, for example, and interesting records going back certainly to the late Middle Ages. It was obviously a well-established church by the 12th, 13th century.
In terms of some features, you pointed out the Grinling Gibbons, and you said there were other carvings. Can you tell me about any other wood pieces of woodwork that were...
Well, we have a beautiful font with a lovely cover involving the four evangelists rising above a stone basin.
Mm.
We had our first baptism in many years here not too long ago, and we were a little bit shocked by the condition of the font, so we all brought in our best salad bowls, and the nicest one sat in the font in lieu of actually using the font.
Yeah.
The pulpit was dismantled during the war, but saved by that reason. So if you look at it twice, you'll see that it's been nicely restored at the back. Originally, like all of these churches, it would have had three desks. So there would have been a reader's desk and a clerk's desk, and it would have made a little more sense architecturally rather than standing on this tall spindle with a little staircase going up to it. But it still has its original tester, which is the lid, reflective lid from which the sound bounces off.
Yes.
One of the features of this church is, of course, the fact that it was a survivor during the war. It did have the six rounds of collateral damage, but the first one started when they blew up the hotel on the corner the second night of the Blitz.
Right.
And the custodians here thought, this is going to get serious, we'd better do something, and immediately took steps to take down everything portable, box in everything not portable. And a lot of it actually went one way and another in boxes, first to St. Paul's and then to the West Country and then back to the church. Okay. So it was preserved, but a lot of it needed serious restoration. Yeah. So it really wasn't until 1958 that they finally finished restoring all the bits and pieces.
Thank goodness. And talking about the other bits in here, you mentioned that there are box pews around the edges, sort of south and the north of the church. At the back as well, I suppose.
Yeah, but the church warden's pews at the back, yes.
And the ones we're sitting in now are lower. So originally it would have all been these higher box pews.
Which you realize if you're a church watching volunteers, which we call our volunteers who meet and greet folks, because in churches like this one today, when the heating isn't working, after 4 hours, you're quite chilly. Mm. And in the days of the four-hour sermons, you really would have felt this. Yeah. And the box pews do actually protect you a good deal from the weather. Well, and of course, historically, pews were assigned to, and in fact, even paid for by many places by individual families. Yeah. So it was your private possession. And if you were going to, you know, a 3-4 hour service, and you're going to two of those on a Sunday, you would, you know, bring
your blankies,
and, yes, one of those little devices that show up on Antiques Roadshow for ladies to pee in, and maybe a hard-boiled egg to put in your mittens, and you know, you really would. It would have been rather cozy, although you could also have been doing the racing form for all that the rector could see from the top
of
the pulpit.
Yes, doing anything. Yes. That's true. So, other features of the church. There are two sword rests. Are they of interest? All
sword rests are of interest, and we have nicely a matching pair.
Yeah.
We know from old illustrations that they used to be at the back of the church.
Right.
So, and we also have a wonderful weather vane, as was, of a pelican, which is a favorite symbol in this church. And it used to be on the weather vane. Now it used to be on the south side of the church. Now it's on the north side of the church. So you have to watch out for these features moving around quite a lot.
So hold on. The pelican that's just, as you say, now on the north side of the church over the door that goes into the office, I suppose. That was on top of a weather vane.
That was originally a weather vane.
On this church.
Yeah. Yes. And the pelican is kind of a favorite symbol here because it also features in a beautiful version on top of Grenlin Gibbon's altarpiece. And there's a lovely little modern one on the rector's board, which was only carved after the war. I think what you really want to do in this church is walk right round it. And maybe even nowadays use your smartphone with the built-in torch to really look at the details, because you see there's stuff just everywhere. We have a charming banner from the Mothers Union, because at the beginning of the 20th century, this was still a very lively parish, as many of them were, because a lot of people still lived here. So we had a Mothers Union of all things. And we have our own banner.
Is the Mothers Union banner that one?
With a lovely Virgin Mary on it,
It's lovely.
Cradling a little child.
Yes.
And many of the city churches would have had a Mothers Union, they would have had cricket leagues, they had knitting circles, they had amazing life well into the 1920s, and that's when the population finally plummets for the last time.
Who uses the church today? Is it used as a parish church, a guild church, a ward church?
It is a guild church, that misleading name that makes people think about livery companies. We do have one livery company here, and we do love the fruiterers, but we've only got the one. But that means that the Church of England service is during the week, and here it's on a Wednesday, and that frees up the church for someone else on a Sunday. So our present guest congregation are Russian Orthodox, of a persuasion that they try and find a church similar to Russian Orthodox and come up with a service that is a bit reflects the host country as well as their own practices. They're getting elderly, so they only come once a month now. But we also have three AA groups who meet here regularly of evenings. We have choir practices all the time. We've got one coming in later today, even this afternoon. The secret lives of these churches, I think, are unappreciated by people who just walk by them during the business day. You don't see how busy they are of an evening, and every evening of the week, basically. If you look twice, you'll see their churches with lights on because something's happening, and what extra life they have on Sundays.
Yeah.
So there's also a wonderful story I've just unearthed looking at the records in the London Metropolitan Archives, that during the war, there was a move to put an air raid shelter in the churchyard here, an overground one.
Yeah.
But it would mean digging up the beautiful Victorian pavement, which is absolutely stunning. You hardly see it today because it's covered with restaurant tables from the adjacent bars, but it's a beautiful piece of paving. And the church warden here, Lord Evesham, fought a splendid rear guard action to prevent this happening, because there really wasn't much residential population to protect, and there were plenty of other shelters within running distance. And he played every card in his hand, from health and safety all the way through, and as a last-ditch attempt, he tried what would now be the first line of defense, archaeology. and he got the city surveyor to come and have a poke around and discovered that the church crypt is in fact under the pavement outside. Turns out not very far under. But on the other hand, from what I can see from the records, there are actually still bodies under that pavement, not very far down. Right. So it would have been completely inappropriate to have dug it up. But it made an amazing contrast to how we treat heritage then and how we treat heritage now.
So thank goodness he was successful.
He was. God bless him. He was a wily old character, Lord Evesham, but he knew what he was doing.
And very last question. What do you like most about this church?
I think it's the fact that it is so beautifully integrated from virtually every generation that's ever been here. It really feels like a Wren church, but if you look at the dates, you'll find most of the monuments are a generation or so later. Many of the interventions are maybe a century or so later as they messed around with the pews and so forth. There's modern art. There's a small head of Christ, which was a donation in like after the war. Yeah. There's bits and pieces from just about every period, and it all just harmonizes because it's all part of the growing life of the church. It's still a living church. It's still very much in use, and many, many people just love it. And since we moved in particularly and started taking a little more care of it, so many people said it just feels like a church that's used and loved. Yes. And it absolutely does.
Thank you, Signa, for a comprehensive and lively insight into this Christopher Wren gem of a church. This postscript is just to let the listener know that the Russian church that she mentioned had been meeting here on a Sunday no longer do. And I was due to attend and record one of their services in the hope of adding some extra sound to the podcast, but was unfortunately thwarted by their departure. But we will be hearing more from Signa in the St. Margaret Lothbury podcast.